It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 5 years ago, southwestern Wisconsin was hit by an unprecedented flash flood that destroyed homes, businesses, and infrastructure. Now, government officials and a grassroots community group are recommending a new way of dealing with flooding. As Hope Kerwin reports, their proposal is to decommission a system of dams built 70 years ago.
A small, unnamed creek flows through Tucker Greedebeck's farm in Monroe County. This fall, the water was only about ankle deep. But when it rains, water rushes down the steep slopes of the Driftless region into the valley. It's why, more than 60 years ago, federal officials built a flood control dam there. In August of 2018, about 12 inches of rain fell over the area in roughly 6 hours. Greedebeck says he knew immediately that everything had changed after the storm.
Looking down through the trees, all I could see was sand. I could see white, and I knew everything was gone.
Half of the valley behind the dam had filled with water, overtopping the structure and bursting through the bluff of sandstone on one side. Today, the 40-foot grass-covered dam still ends in an abrupt drop, and huge chunks of sandstone dot the land.
You know, having something this big that backed up so much water, and when it fails, it's catastrophic.
The dam on Greedebeck's farm was one of five that failed in the Coon Creek and West Fork Kickapoo watersheds during the 2018 flood. Major flooding has become more common in the region in the last 2 decades, a trend scientists say is driven by climate change. In the aftermath of any natural disaster, attention turns to rebuilding. But recovery hasn't been simple here. Officials have realized that replacing these flood control dams that were built in the early 1960s is not the most cost-effective way forward. Steve Becker is state conservation engineer for the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the federal agency that built the dams. The flood that destroyed the dam on Greedebeck's farm is what's called a full pool event, and a repeat could be dangerous.
No one wants to see that type of a sudden breach if another full pool event occurs. Those sudden damages can take people off guard and can result in, you know, loss of life.
That's one reason why the NRCS is recommending that 22 of the dams in the two watersheds be removed. Becker says that over the last 60 years, the dams have brought about 90 cents in flood control benefits for every dollar spent on construction and maintenance. But moving forward, rebuilding or reinforcing the dams would only provide around 10 cents in benefits to every dollar spent. That's mainly from increased construction costs. The NRCS will release the final draft of their Coon Creek Watershed Project Plan this month. After that, it will be up to county officials to decide how to move forward. But some residents are already working toward a future without the dams.
We know that there are structural issues, and so what we need to do is learn to live without them.
That's Nancy Wedwick, a longtime resident of the village of Coon Valley. She says local history inspired her and her neighbors to come together to form the Coon Creek Community Watershed Council. In the 1930s, the Coon Creek watershed was home to the first soil conservation project in the nation. The Civilian Conservation Corps worked with local farmers to stop the rampant erosion and flash flooding that was tearing apart the area during the Dust Bowl era. Wedwick says today, the council's goal is to raise awareness about land practices that can prevent flooding by putting more precipitation into the ground where it falls.
Here we are again now 90 years later, right? We've lost our way in some cases, and that, of course, is compounded by the, you know, change in climate and all of the weather that we are now seeing. But the important thing to remember is that we did this before.
In September, the group hosted a 90th anniversary celebration for the original Coon Creek Watershed Project to celebrate the history of their area and acknowledge the new set of challenges the region faces. Wedwick says it will take everyone in the watershed working together, but she's optimistic residents can do something to lessen the impact of floods like they did nearly a century ago. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore wife-carrying races that trace a history to Finland, and now we're popping up at Wisconsin community events, and there's space to talk. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Justine Raessler is one half of the reigning North American wife-carrying championship team. Justine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, Caleb Raessler here as well, the other half of the team, and they live in Waukesha. Caleb, welcome.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you so much for having us.
Good morning. So describe a typical wife-carrying competition for those of us who've never witnessed one.
Yeah, well, it's a really cool event. It's definitely a spectator sport, believe it or not. The atmosphere is kind of unlike, you know, many races I've participated in my life, in terms of there's fans lined the whole course and just cheering you on and just wanting to see kind of the event itself. But effectively, it only takes about, around a minute. It's a fast race. You go over a couple hurdles, you run through water pit, and obviously wife carrying, you're carrying your wife on your back. You can do a piggyback ride. You can do a fireman's carry. You can do something that's called the Estonian carry, where basically it's kind of like a different version of a piggyback ride. And yeah, you run and you kind of try to jump over these hurdles and run through a little water pit and just do it as fast as you can, or just have as much fun as you can.
What happens if you drop your Justine as you go through an obstacle?
Well, the immediate impact. Exactly.
Yeah, well, are there disqualifications or do you just put them back on? How does it work?
There's a time penalty. It's 5 to 10 seconds, I think, depending on the course, somewhere around there. So there's definitely a time and penalty and incentive not to drop them. But yeah, as Justine said, most importantly, you're kind of in big trouble at home. So you definitely try to avoid it.
Justine, go ahead.
I was just going to say, a lot of the people who are getting carried do wear helmets because sometimes it can be, people can get hurt depending on, you know, how they are dropped or where they're dropped at. So I do wear a helmet when we race just in case.
How did the idea of taking part in a wife carrying race first occur to you two? Justine, go ahead.
So that's actually more on Caleb. He had heard about like the craziest competitions on ESPN a while ago, I think. We ended up, it was like, I don't know, was that 10 years ago or so? And then we just kind of forgot about it. Here we are trying it again.
Can you walk through the different ways to be carried, Justine, and in which way works best for you?
Sure. Yeah. As Caleb said before, like there's a couple different ways people do it. And the way we prefer is it's called the Estonian, and it's basically like a piggyback upside down. So like my head is up against his back. And then my legs are wrapped around his neck, basically. So it's the most effective carry, and I try to squeeze tight and make it like a backpack almost, so I'm not bouncing around, which makes it easier on both of us.
Okay, I can see that. And then a fireman's carry, what would that be?
Is that just on the shoulders, Caleb? That's just on the shoulders.
That's just on top of your shoulders, yeah.
Okay. Caleb, how much advantage in this sport is determined by the height and the weight of competitors?
I definitely think it's a big deal. You know, if you go see the winners, you know, they put the top three or four couples on a podium. You know, you're going to see taller gentlemen like myself with, a wife that's much shorter. So, you know, there's not much way around that. But, you know, there's been some, you know, people come in all shapes and sizes. And, you know, surprisingly, there was a guy who's a strong man from Maine who won a couple of years, and he was very short and very muscular and very powerful guy. So, there's definitely, that stuff definitely plays an aspect. And there's different courses too. The championships, they're at a ski resort, so it's a very steep hill, so you have to be able to run up and down a hill, whereas like the one in Wisconsin is very flat.
What about openness here? Are same-sex couples welcome in this competition?
Yeah, they, it feels like it's a very welcoming event, right? Like, you know, there's only some percentage of people who show up that are, you know, trying to run as fast as they can and think they have a shot to win the race. And then there's a lot of people that wear costumes, and you know, the fans are just trying to see wipeouts and see people fall in the water, and it's a fun event. You'll see some, you know, you'll see some high school kids, some buddies carrying each other. You'll see all sorts of variations of people just saying, hey, could we even get through the course carrying each other? So they're pretty open to anybody participating. They don't take themselves too seriously.
Caleb and Justine Raisler of Waukesha, they're two-time North American wife-carrying champions. And you can call in with a question, share your thoughts at any point. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the world of wife-carrying contests and how this Finnish sport is spreading to Wisconsin. Justine and Caleb Raisler of Waukesha are two-time North American wife-carrying champions, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share your views at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So, Caleb, in October, you and Justine won for the second year in a row the North American Wife-Carrying Championships that were held at a resort in Maine. What did you win?
Yeah, it's kind of a fun gift. You know, you win your wife's weight in beer. So they put her on a teeter-tot, and they balance it out with beer, and the crowd tries to encourage them to give more and more. And so it's a fun event. And then for us, we have to fly home, so you share the wealth. So, you know, a lot of times the winners just give out the beer to the crowd. So that's one half of the gift. And then the second half is your wife's weight times five in dollars. So that, you know, that helps pay for part of the trip, which is nice.
Justine, how do you feel about your weight determining the winnings?
I just think it's kind of funny. I think you kind of know going into it if you're kind of qualifying to win, that's just going to kind of be part of it. If we're winning money, I think it's great.
Well, in terms of training, how do you train for wife carrying races, Caleb?
You know, so I think it's some mix of, you know, just running for cardio fitness, lifting weights, and then doing some more intense sprints. And I think for any individual, you just want to see which of those you enjoy the most, which of the ones you feel like you see the most progress. You know, we all react a little bit different to exercise. So it's just a good balance of those three things. The course is pretty hilly. So for this event in particular, we live on a hill. So, you know, just try to do a fair amount of hill running.
Justine, do your athletic backgrounds as runners and swimmers help during these events?
I mean, to be honest, I'm not doing much of the work besides hanging on for dear life. but I mean, I think obviously being a tad bit more petite is useful, in a competition like this one.
So let's talk about the origins here. Caleb, the sport comes from Finland, and some of the legends say it started with this Finnish man in the 1800s known as Rokainen the Robber. This gang of thieves reportedly stole food and abducted women from neighboring villages. What is your understanding of the history?
No, I've heard the same story, you know, on the website when we first researched the race as well. You know, that the one version is that was just mimicking that, and it took off. Another version was that's how they trained to perform that task. So it definitely has a interesting origin, and hopefully to the best of their ability, they've made light of that and try to repurpose it for a little bit more lighthearted, fun purpose.
Justine, what do you make of that history that reenacts a practice that was extremely brutal to women? How do you process that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just I agree. I think it's great to be able to put a good positive spin on it. I hope that the legend is wrong and that's just not what happened, but unfortunate if it was.
Let's look to the future of this sport. Are there sponsorships involved or any sponsorships happening on the horizon?
Not that we know of, I guess. If we end up going to Finland, for the world championship that would help the cost. But as of right now, no, I think it's just a fun thing that Caleb and I like to do for a couple's getaway, I guess.
Caleb, do you anticipate this could become an Olympic demonstration sport one day?
I don't think so. You know, I think there's even like some of the more serious sports like obstacle racing and stuff. I think they've had their challenges to get a new sport. So you know, I don't think it'll become that serious. It only attracts a pretty niche audience.
We're talking about wife carrying competitions, which has its origins in Finland. And we have the two-time North American champions, Justine and Caleb Raisler of Waukesha. You can join in with your questions. You can add some comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Perhaps this is tongue-in-cheek, but Paul from Summit called. Paul wonders, what happens in a race if the couple has an argument that morning before the race?
Yeah, that would be unfortunate.
So, yeah, I would imagine because there is a lot of teamwork here involved, Caleb.
Yeah.
How do you two get psyched up for the race? How do you work together?
Yeah, well, Justine sold herself short earlier. You know, the wife has to have good balance and she has to hang on tight. And I can tell you from the first time we practice it, if she doesn't, it's so much harder. So she does a great job and it definitely takes some effort for her to have that kind of bravery. but yeah, she, you know, in terms of motivation, the first time we ever did it, she said, you better win and you better not drop me. And that's all the motivation I need to know. Those are my goals.
What is the most difficult obstacle for you to get through, Caleb? What is the one that is trickiest?
I would say, I mean, when you're running through the water pit, if the water's deep and it's really muddy, it's just, you can't really maintain momentum. You have to really slow down. So that's just the hardest part.
Okay, so it's those, the water. And then if you, have you dropped Justine? Like, what has that situation been like?
We've done three races. There's been no dropping. I would say this last time it was super rainy. We have a good friend who's done this race like 28 years in Maine, and he said it was the muddiest he'd ever seen it. So practically every competitor slipped on some level. We slipped a little bit, so Justine for the first time got her head wet, which wasn't great, but you know, thankfully we've been safe. And for the most part, when you watch the races, you know, I've never seen anything in person serious in terms of injury.
How do you think you would do at the wife carrying world championships in Finland?
I mean, I think we'd have a decent chance of competing for the title, you know, just based on history, the people that have won the main one have went over and done well. So, but again, you know, we don't take it too serious. We try to run as fast as we can because we like the challenge, but, you know, we just try to have fun and enjoy the experience.
Justine, do you have an eye on the future of one day competing in Finland?
Yeah, I think it would actually be a really fun event. I mean, I think it'd be fun to go over and be able to travel and do that kind of stuff as a secondary part of it. So that's kind of more of a motivation. But yeah, the course itself, it's just different, which is kind of the fun part about it. Every state kind of does a different course. But I think it would be fun. And I do think Caleb has we have a really good chance at it. He's pretty suited for that kind of stuff. So.
I understand.
Yeah,
I understand you also are juggling small kiddos at home. How do they process like mom and dad's sport? Like, how do you talk about it with the kids?
Yeah, so our oldest daughter thinks it's super fun. She's seen us race once so far. And then our younger ones are too young to kind of know what's going on. But yeah, we do a couple, you know, just practices and our daughter finds it to be kind of funny. So
she's probably like, why don't you just hold all of us for practice?
Well, I think a lot of people who kind of don't understand the sport are all thinking the same thing. Like, why are you doing this?
So in terms of like, as you do these competitions, Caleb, are there points for winning or some accrual of win system through a season? I mean, could you track through a season?
Not to my knowledge. I don't think there is. There's, you know, you'll find some local ones throughout throughout the country that just offer, and it's just kind of, again, you win the prize at the end of the race if you do win, and that's all you're really competing for. And then obviously they have the North American Championship and they have a World Championship, but you know, there's a couple of people that are really into it that'll go to all the major races in a year, but I don't think anything really carries over from one race to the next.
In our final moments together, how could Wisconsin further embrace wife-carrying competitions?
Honestly, you know, the Monona course in outside of Madison is pretty amazing. They kind of sold us on the experience. I mean, it was way, way better than we expected. So we're like, wow, this is just a fun thing to do to bond as a couple. Like, we both really enjoy it, and it's just a, you know, fun experience. So I think anybody who attends that experience, you know, I'd recommend it. It's super fun to watch as a spectator, and they have an announcer, and they just make a great time of it. So I don't think there's a ton more they can do. You know, you could obviously advertise it more if you wanted, but I think they do a good job advertising that Monona Festival. So,
well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Caleb and Justine Raisler of Waukesha, they're two-time North American wife-carrying champions. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the push for voters in Wisconsin and other states to amend their constitutions to enshrine new rights and the effect it's having. First, a political battle over diversity programs at the universities of Wisconsin is the latest sticking point between Republicans and the university system. In the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision striking down affirmative action in college admissions, Rich Kramer reports there are real questions about what campus diversity policies will look like in the future.
At UW-Parkside's freshman orientation, around 50 students and parents are spread out in a campus auditorium. The lights dim for a video message from the former chancellor.
Diversity is a signature feature at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Students from over 20 countries are part of our learning community. I'm Chancellor Debbie Ford, and you are welcome here.
It's a familiar message, but off campus, videos like this are newly controversial. Republican lawmakers have targeted the universities of Wisconsin over their diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. UW Parkside freshman Anaya Young of Milwaukee wants to be a child psychologist one day. She says she chose the school because it feels like an inclusive campus. She was unaware of the political battle over DEI.
I just don't understand why they would be upset about it. I don't.
Young disagrees with GOP claims that diversity programs divide students by race and offer advantages to some groups and not others.
I don't think that is racial preference. I think that is racial appreciation.
One powerful critic of DEI programming is Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. At the state GOP convention in June, he told the crowd the letters should stand for
division, exclusion, and indoctrination.
He claimed the concept has become the new religion for the left.
So the overt racism, the overt exclusion, the overt indoctrination is so deep inside the UW system, I am embarrassed to be an alumni.
Voss followed up this speech with action against the universities and their employees. At a time when Wisconsin had a multi-billion dollar budget surplus, Republicans cut the UW's budget by $32 million. Voss is now blocking pay raises for around 34,000 workers until DEI positions and programs are eliminated. Attorney Dan Lennington of the conservative Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty says a June U.S. Supreme Court ruling banning the consideration of race in college admissions means many college diversity programs are now illegal.
And all I would say is that if you couldn't do it to an African American, you can't do it to a white person. So whatever the DEI training happens to be, you can basically tell whether it's illegal or unconstitutional by just flipping the script.
Catherine Meyer studies education policy at the Brookings Institution. She says the Supreme Court's ruling was narrow, but she expects conservatives to ask the High Court to change that. Meyer sees two broad trends at play in the current battle over DEI. Republican voters, she says, have a less positive view of higher education, for one.
The other is just this broader trend that there is a history of racial backlash in America.
Meyer and other DEI supporters say it's about making more students feel welcome on college campuses. While the number of students from what the UW calls underrepresented minority groups has grown by 19% in the past decade, white students still outnumber them by around 6-1. At the same time, graduation rates for Black, Hispanic, and American Indian students at state universities are between 14 and 25% lower than they are for white students. President of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce, Tim Sheehy, said in July that, for the business community, DEI isn't a fad. He says companies are embracing efforts to make themselves more welcoming to workers from minority groups.
If you look at the workplaces we have today, if you look at workplaces in Wisconsin, just put simply, we are not going to fill those jobs with the white population. It's not growing fast enough.
At the Wisconsin Capitol, the DEI battle continues. Bosses standing firm on blocking pay raises until colleges axe diversity initiatives, and Democratic Governor Tony Evers is suing Voss and other lawmakers, claiming the holdup is unconstitutional. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And WPR staff are employees of UW-Madison. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As legislative Republicans use Wisconsin's constitutional amendment process to pursue new laws on a range of policies, we examine this political maneuvering and how it affects states. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John Dinan is chair of the Politics and International Affairs Department at Wake Forest University in North Carolina, studies state constitutionalism, federalism, and American political development. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me today.
A newsroom here, Wisconsin Watch, reporting state lawmakers are considering as many constitutional amendments this session as they have in the past two decades combined. What is the advantage in our state of passing laws through a constitutional amendment?
Well, I guess we'd start with what would be the motivations for passing constitutional amendments. And in a situation where you have divided government, where you have the legislature controlled by one party, governor in control of another party, and perhaps a Supreme Court of a different ideological dimension, you will oftentimes see states see legislators propose amendments as a way of taking their views directly to the people and seeing if the people will ratify them. Because, of course, constitutional amendments do not get to be vetoed or signed by the governor. And constitutional amendments are superior over Supreme Court decisions at the state level. So that would clearly be motivating some of the move towards relying on constitutional amendments in Wisconsin and in some other states.
How do you feel about that sentiment that giving voters more of a voice in a time of this extreme partisanship and divided government, that makes sense?
So we really have to divide the states into the 50 states into two categories. One is that there's 17 states that actually allow voters a lot of power to actually initiate constitutional amendments. Of course, this is a power that's possessed in Ohio, Michigan, and to some degree in Illinois. It's not possessed in Wisconsin. It's not possessed in Minnesota. In those states, the people have immense amount of ability. They can bypass the governing officials altogether by proposing amendments, crafting them, putting on the ballot, and voting on them. In the other states that don't have that ability, and Wisconsin would be one of them, it does require the legislature to take the affirmative step of going to the people. In some ways, that's a recognition of the ultimate power in the U.S. political system is popular sovereignty, and it recognizes the ability of the people to approve or disapprove of those amendments. And it is very important that amendments going on the ballot is no guarantee that they will be passed. Voters are perfectly willing to vote down amendments that they find unwise or improper.
We think we feel more activity here in Wisconsin. You've been studying state constitutions for decades. Nationwide, are there more active efforts to change state constitutions now than in past times?
So if we look at the numbers, we actually see more stability than change over time. That is, every 2 years, and most states operate a two-year cycle, about 100 amendments are approved around the country. And that number has been relatively stable over the last half decade, maybe even slightly down from where it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago. But to say that the overall numbers across the country are stable is not to say that you don't see surges on particular issues and in particular states. And so we are seeing a surge right now in proposing amendments on the constitutional level in regard to abortion rights. And so we just had Ohio just last week approve an amendment to its constitution guaranteeing a right to abortion up to a certain degree. And that followed three other states that passed similar amendments just last November. And that is along with several other states that will vote next year. So you do see a surge on particular issues and in certain states. If we add things out across the country, though, more stability than change.
So let's turn to the wording. In Wisconsin, lawmakers write the questions on ballots that voters consider to either pass or reject. How often do lawmakers have the power to write ballot questions for constitutional amendments?
So when we're talking about state constitutional amendments in the 50 states, in this area, as in so many other areas, there is such a range and diversity of approaches on practically anything that we ask. How many votes does it take for a legislature to propose an amendment and put it on the ballot? How many votes does it take for the people to ratify amendments? And on this question, how is the ballot language written? There will be at least four or five different answers depending on the states. Some other states do it the way that Wisconsin does, where the legislature has control over as we pass the amendment proposal, we are drawing the language. But other states have a wide range of other procedures in which they direct the Secretary of State to draw this up, or they have a particular procedure where the matter would have to go before a state Supreme Court for review even before it could go on the ballot. Now, we shall say, even in states that don't provide for explicit Supreme Court review, there's always the possibility that a litigant could bring that case to the court system and say, I believe that this language is improper. And that has been the source of much litigation around the country.
I would imagine, I mean, every word has to be so carefully chosen so that it's accurate and descriptive enough so that the person who's reading it at the ballot box can understand what's going on.
It's a very important thing to focus on. The first question is, okay, what are we going to put on the ballot policy-wise or rights-wise? But then the next question turns to, how are we going to frame that language? We want it to be accurate, and but then there's the question of, there are ways that you could use two different words to describe things, both of them be accurate. And what we know from polling, from public opinion research, voters can react very differently depending on the different framing. And so it is a critical question of how that ballot language gets written. It's no surprise that goes into court on a number of occasions, and people have very different views on what the language should be.
What I wonder, John Dinan, is should we be concerned? Should we be concerned about doing some type of damage to our state constitution, like amending it improperly or too many times, or adding things that are not really appropriate for the constitution?
So this is a classic question when we talk about constitutional amendments, and it's probably helpful just to take a perspective here of looking at the federal level. The federal level, it's very difficult to amend the U.S. Constitution, and there's not much of an appetite for doing so. And so there have been only 27 amendments to the U.S. Constitution throughout American history. And 10 of those were the Bill of Rights that were adopted right after ratification. That means that only 17 times has the U.S. Constitution been amended in over 200 years. The situation is very different at the state level. Every single state constitution is more easily amended and is amended more often than at the federal level. So we have a different constitutional culture at the state level. That being said, there are some states where, in Texas, it's not unusual to see 9 or 10 constitutional amendments on the ballot in a given year, and people don't blink at that. They say, well, that's just what we do here. In other states, in the Midwest and in New England, if you ever saw 10 constitutional constitutional amendments on the ballot, people would say, what has happened here and what are we doing? So even within the states, there's a different approach to this. If we talk about, well, what are the advantages and disadvantages of a regular resort to the amendment process, we would say that one of the clear disadvantages is that you entrench things in a constitution and then make it more difficult if your views change on that. The upside of this is the very flip side of that. Sometimes you want to entrench things. You want to make sure that rights are protected against fleeting majorities that might change in the political process. It's a classic debate, and there are arguments to be advanced on both sides of the benefits and disadvantages of a regular resort to amending a state constitution.
Wake Forest University political scientist John Dinan studies the effects of state constitutional amendments through time. Call in with the question. Share your perspective at any point. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the legislative session underway in Wisconsin, lawmakers consider almost as many amendments as have been passed over the last 20 years combined. That's from the Wisconsin Watch newsroom. Call in with the question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John Dinan is chair of the Politics and International Affairs Department at Wake Forest University, author of books about state constitutional politics. John, turning to abortion, let's go more deeply here. You say state constitutional amendments are shaping abortion policy in the United States. Tell us what's going on.
So once the U.S. Supreme Court issues its Dobbs decision last summer and ensures that state governments are going to be primarily responsible for determining abortion policy, we now turn our attention to the various institutions and persons at the state level and the vehicles for shaping policy. Of course, legislators are some of the actors. They'll be passing abortion laws, permissive or restrictive. Of course, state Supreme Courts will be issuing decisions on the legality and constitutionality of those laws. But another vehicle is the constitutional amendment process. And so what we've seen in the year and a half since the Dobbs decision is we have seen four states now pass constitutional amendments to their state constitutions guaranteeing a right to abortion or reproductive autonomy in some fashion. And Ohio is the latest state to do so last week. This follows in the years preceding Dobbs. There were a handful of state constitutional amendments that went in exactly the opposite direction and explicitly stated that there shall not be understood to be a right to abortion in the state constitution. So we have seen state constitutions be a battleground for abortion policy, just as legislators and state courts are. We can expect to see next year and in coming years a number of additional proposals for amending state constitutions, generally for the purpose of securing extra protection or guaranteeing protection for abortion rights and reproductive autonomy. There's already a measure on the ballot in Maryland for next year, and there are other proposals as well.
I wonder how pivotal then are citizen-drafted amendments to the question of reproductive rights in the future. What do you see there?
So that the 17 states mm-hmm. that allow for citizen-initiated vote constitutional amendments, those are oftentimes where the battleground is particularly strong. Because what happens is you can have a state where the legislature will have a certain view on abortion policy, and yet in a state such as Ohio, where the voters have the ability to put an amendment on the ballot independent of the legislature, they can basically overturn the legislature's views. And that is what happened in Ohio last week. And it's what is being proposed to happen in states such as Missouri and Florida and other states that have the voter-initiated amendment process.
Looking at voting, next year, Wisconsin voters could weigh in on at least two constitutional amendments. One would bar the use of private grants in election administration. Another would prohibit non-citizens from voting in Wisconsin elections. How common nationally are constitutional amendments about voting access or elections?
If we add up, about 100 amendments approved every 2 years around the country, voting-related amendments are pretty common. And they come in the following categories. You will see in some states establish redistricting commissions, where particularly voters are driving this, but sometimes legislatures. Let's take away from legislatures the task of drawing district lines and give it to a commission. You also see this in some cases with advancing right to vote in certain ways and removing restrictions that might be there. And then you also see it in a series of other categories. When Wisconsin voters are poised to vote on the question of basically preventing local governments or any other governments in the state from allowing non-citizens to vote, they are following in the footsteps of a handful of other states that have passed similar amendments just in the last few years, and Iowa voters will also be voting on a similar amendment next year. So what we see in the state constitutional amendment areas, you see surges of interest and groups that are recommending passage, and you see ideas circulating around the country. And so Wisconsin is more in keeping with than different from other states in seeing a surge of election-related amendments.
John Dinan studies constitutional amendments across the U.S., chairs the Politics and International Affairs Department at Wake Forest University. You can join in the discussion, call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234. John, is it more difficult to make changes to a policy once it becomes, enshrined in the state constitution?
It very much is. And so that's the classic question. If folks say, if we're dealing with, say, policy matters, is it better for the legislature to handle these and not elevate it to a constitutional status? Or is it preferable to actually entrench it in the Constitution? And clearly, one of the downsides of entrenching policy matters in the Constitution is that if you want to change that, you then have to go through the same process again of amending the Constitution. So Colorado faced this several years ago. Colorado actually put marijuana legalization in its state constitution, as some other states have done. Well, it was a very lengthy ballot measure, and they wanted to revise it several years later. They had to go through the process of thereby amending the Constitution once again to revise that. If that had rested in a legislative statute, it would not have been as difficult to do. So that's clearly one of the downsides of elevating things to a constitutional status. Do you want to entrench things in such a way that future changes require a more difficult process?
In our last few seconds together, do you think that federal constitutional amendments will gain any traction in Congress?
So to get an amendment passed through Congress requires two-thirds of vote in both houses. It's very difficult to get two-thirds vote in both houses of Congress for anything significant. So it has been several decades since we've got a federal constitutional amendment passed. Very little activity there. That's in contrast with the states where the barriers to amending state constitutions are much lower and the willingness to do so is much greater. So you see a lot of activity at the state level in various states and on various issues in terms of constitutional amendment activity.
Sure.
We have not seen that translate into increased federal constitutional amendment activity, given the high barriers to doing so.
John, thank you for joining us.
I was glad to have the opportunity.
John Dinan, Chair of the Politics and International Affairs Department at Wake Forest University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.